and welcome to The Incremental Edge. My name is Emma Pownall, and I'm delighted to introduce you to our Private Equity Spotlight, where we bring together experts to explore what private equity is, how it differs from other forms of investment, and what to expect from the journey, ranging from the first 100 days right through to a CFO's guide to planning a successful exit strategy. I was recently joined by a fantastic panel of experts. We had Stephen McNichol from Sage, Robert Umpleby from Clearwater International Corporate Finance, Michelle Mullaney from MHA Corporate Finance, and Matt Hansen from Evolution Funding. Each brought their own unique views and first-hand experience to the discussion. If you're an exec looking to attract private equity investment, a finance professional experiencing investment for the first time, or if you're simply curious about the process, then this is for you. I'm joined by four fantastic experts. If you'd just like to introduce yourselves.
Hi, Stephen McNichol, VP of Retail and SSG at Sage. At Sage, I'm accountable for driving the commercial and product teams across our specialist vertical solutions.
Thanks, Stephen.
Hi, I'm Rob Umpleby. I'm a director in the corporate finance team at Clearwater International. Been doing M&A for about 7 or 8 years now, mainly focused on the tech vertical, but I've done everything from sort of Series A transactions through to large secondary buyouts.
So I'm Michelle Mullaney. I'm head of deal origination at MHA Corporate Finance. So we focus on that sort of private mid-market, or any deals right across kind of debt or equity funding, right through to exits that might be MBOs, PE, right through to employee ownership.
Hi, Matt Hansen, Group CFO of Evolution Funding. I've held C-suite and director positions across multiple PE entities doing buy and build, refinances, and also successful exits.
Okay, so before we jump into the different stages of private equity, I thought we'd just talk about some of the fundamentals. Stephen, can you briefly touch on what private equity is and how it differs from other forms of investment?
Yeah, so private equity is effectively investment in a non-listed business. And that investment is ultimately to expand the value of the company over the time of ownership. Typically, it forms in three different stages. So there's venture capital, which is that investment in the early stage investment. There's growth equity, which is the investment when a business really needs capital to accelerate. And then there's full-on buyouts, which is where PE house will take a majority stake in a business and look to really drive value over the course of a lifetime of its ownership.
Brilliant. And Michelle, what type of companies typically attract private equity investment?
Yeah, sure. I'd say from a sector perspective, we're sort of seeing a lot of activity in companies that are in technology and healthcare and business services. Not to say other sectors don't attract interest. For example, there's specific consumer product funds. In the Northwest, we've got the likes of, say, a River Capital that are looking at those sort of smaller check sizes and businesses that you wouldn't typically maybe think fit that PE mold. I would say as a whole, PE are looking for businesses that are on a really strong, steep growth trajectory with good margins, and with their money behind them, that's going to sort of supercharge that growth.
Rob, can you explain a bit about how private equity works within these businesses?
I certainly can, yeah. So so private equity typically invest for maybe a 3 to 4 year cycle, and that's often dictated by how they raise the funds themselves. But over that time frame, you know, broad brush, they're looking to between double and triple their money. So, you know, hence why they're attracted to high growth sectors and opportunities where the business is, you know, either a market leader or able to really drive growth over that period. In terms of how it works from start to finish, there's loads of different flavors of it, as Steve's alluded to, but you know, typically, when the PE fund invests. Some members of the management team will also get some equity to help drive that growth. And then there's an option around whether or not the existing shareholders either cash out or roll into the new structure. And that depends on what the purpose of the deal is, whether it's an MBO or a management buyout, where it's the management team buying out the existing shareholders, or where it's more of a growth equity deal where there's a private equity house coming in to inject cash into the business, either to, you know, develop something, you know, you mentioned tech, develop a new software product, or in fact go on a, you know, a buy and build type strategy where you're going out and acquiring lots of different businesses to build a larger group. So we could spend hours going through how private equity works, but that's just a bit of an intro to it.
Let's look at it from a CFO's point of view. How does being private equity backed change things within a finance team?
Yeah, I think so. Having experienced it firsthand on multiple occasions, I think sometimes there can be a negative perception initially, or almost an apprehension about PE. But like many things, it's how do you embrace it? And it can very much, it's not just a one-way street. So people will see when they get investment, ultimately, they're looking for that return and they're looking for security. And so they're wanting to make sure that their return is as safe as it can be, number one. And then is it going to grow in the way that they hoped? So the way we have to engage with that is to give them that information. It needs to be timely. They need to feel informed. And I think some people can think, oh, private equity, they're there in these high growth entities, so they're a little bit risky and they're looking at things that are going to grow. They're not. They are not anywhere interested in risk. What they're looking for is certainty and clarity. The two-way street, though, is not just us projecting out information, maybe changing our reporting, both in content and KPIs and in our cadence, but it can also be they've got a wealth of information, you know, that we can draw into that business. They have contacts that are wider than sort of any singular entity. So that's where I would say, you know, if we're looking at how does it affect things, it's a cadence. And ultimately, it's stepping back. We all want to win in the same way. The PE house is going to drive that at times if they're seeing people off their numbers or if they're seeing headwinds. But ultimately, they want to win as much as the other investors. And as Rob was saying, you know, sometimes that's the management team as well. We're also investing.
So it's really about seeing them as a partner and really leaning on them and using their expertise as well as that reporting cadence that's
exactly.
needed.
Exactly. They want to feel informed. They want to feel comfort and informed in a clear way that they can understand and compare with other elements of their investments. You can actually turn that as well and say, you know, come and be more involved with us. You can get that expertise.
Fantastic. Really, really good insight. Thank you. So let's start with that first stage of attracting investment for a business. Stephen, if I can come to you first, what would you say that businesses need to do to become attractive to investment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's so much dependent on the life cycle and where the business is in terms of its growth journey, its trajectory in terms of the industry. But if I think about a couple of key themes that I think go through all different stages, different industries, different businesses, I think that value proposition, how does that business serve its customers? What competitive advantage does it have? And does that resonate in the market? Is it a growing market? Is there scope and is there space for the business to grow? I think looking at the revenue streams and the distribution channels is really important. Understanding whether there are streams and channels which can grow. Partnerships is a key one. Are there any partnerships that can really turbocharge the business, really unlock new avenues that previously wouldn't have been unlocked? Cost. You know, looking at, you know, the level of fixed and variable costs to understand that underlying level of profitability, I think is a really key point as well. And then also the quality of the management team. They're the ones that bring it all together. They're the ones that take it to market. They're the ones that really drive that drumbeat day in, day out. So having a strong management team is really important.
Matt, have you got any practical steps you'd advise CFOs who are going into this attracting investment stage?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, be it a new PE entrants, transitioning from one PE house to the next, or even a refinance, because there's quite a lot of crossover when you're doing that. Ultimately, you're trying to give clarity and confidence to the information you're projecting. You should never forget that when you are living and breathing your entity and your business with your team around you, above you and below you, is the PE house has a point in time to look at you. And so you need to be able to pull that information together to show real clarity of where you have been. And ultimately that, and its extrapolation of that quality of that data and the confidence it can give, allows you to then see where it's going to go. And when you're attracting PE, there's a real balance to say, we've done a lot here, so you can believe that our curve is in this trajectory. And when we say it's going to carry on, that gives confidence, because you want to get that blend of value to them and ultimately to the current owners, be it PE or management teams, to be able to get value in the past and some value for what the future would be. And that very much comes from that sort of quality of information. I'd also say as well, it's being really, really clear at what point you're taking the data. So you could have some heads in there, some investments, some external support, which you go, they're not going to continue. They have a finite period of time based on where our strategy is and what we're doing. And equally, some future investment may come. We may need to get a new system at some point. We may be breaking threshold into a new jurisdiction. That could come with some capitalization of costs. So it's that clarity really is linking for what they're looking for to attract. And so you don't want them to say, you're running at this level of costs and we're going to extrapolate there. You're like, no, actually, we're not. This is going to finish in your tenure, but there's still value to be had on where the next step is. And this is why, actually, it's important to explain your why. Why are you going for another round of PE? Why is it that's the choice for you to be able to go? Because you need to leave something on the table, as it were, to see where they're going to get their returns and ultimately the other investors or management team would as well.
Yeah, so that clarity in data plus what Stephen was saying about that clarity and value prop and how you're going to build from that point is correct. Really key.
Yeah, I'd agree.
And Rob, from a corporate finance perspective, what tends to attract interest and what are the red flags that will put investors off?
So I think, you know, first and foremost, the high growth potential of a business is, you know, as I mentioned, you know, they're looking to broadly double the size of the business over their tenure or over their investment, should I say. So has the business fundamentally got the growth potential to scale over that time period? And I would add to that and say that, you know, that will naturally attribute a business in certain sectors. So if the business has a strong market position in a high growth sector, then that will add to its growth potential. And, you know, we mentioned earlier, this private equity have invested heavily in certain industries across the world that have high growth. So tech being the obvious one, but, you know, pharmaceuticals, I guess financial services, and anything that is, I guess, indexing above the mean from a growth potential. And then in terms of other attractive, I guess, elements, you know, there has to be a strong management team there. The private equity house, in most instances, is not coming in to deliver that growth. They are backing the people that are already in that team, maybe with some new people coming in to augment it and complete it, but ultimately they are backing the fundamentals of that team and their growth plan over that 3 to 5 year period that I mentioned. And then I mentioned, obviously, that they're attracted to certain markets, but they're also attracted to, I guess, growth models themselves. So, you know, whether that's organic or buy and build. And if they have had success within a certain market with a certain strategy before, then they will often reinvest in that. They've been there, they've done it before, they can add value to help someone do it again. So you'll have read in the press, there's a lot of investment from private equity and professional services at the minute, whether that's in law firms, but also in accountancy firms. I guess most recently, Grant Thornton got acquired by, or was got invested by Cinven, which is a mid-cap private equity house. And then in terms of red flags, as you said earlier, they're not looking for risk, but they are looking for potential downfalls, and that will turn them off a certain either sector or in fact business. Picking up on the sector piece, if that sector is really heavily regulated or has the potential to be impacted by government policy, I'm thinking the obvious one is gambling. Very, very rarely will private equity invest in gambling, partly because of their fund rules and the investors in those funds themselves, but also because of the exposure to regulation. And then they'll look at the business and they'll look at it and go, is there a potential for this to go wrong really quickly? And could that be over-reliance on a single customer concentration, or similarly from a supplier perspective, over-reliance on any single supplier? But a part of that private equity investment process will be a large amount of due diligence. And of course, flags will come up in that diligence. It's all about how you manage those kind of, I guess, issues, but also how you have dealt with them previously and how you propose to deal with them going forward.
Yeah, so it's a real conversation then during this stage of attracting investment. It's not just about here's the reports, off you go.
No business is perfect, right? So as you work through that process, speaking to private equity, it's about having the answers and having done the prep work before you come to market to identify potential issues and build a narrative around the story and how you'll deal with them going forward.
So the real thread through all of this is clarity. What sort of reporting are investors expecting to see at this stage, Michelle?
I would say focus really on accuracy. They're certainly not expecting, particularly first time to private equity, that it's, all singing, all dancing, you've nailed it in every area. I'd say, if you're aiming at some of the funds that might be the likes of, say, a Foresight and a Maven, they're probably used to much more unsophisticated businesses. If your first time is maybe the likes of an LDC, then I'd probably say they are probably expecting a little bit more sophistication there. But I would just say it's very much you'll have worked through the due diligence. That will have probably been the first time that you'll have had that granularity of numbers, both in the historics but the forecast, stress tested much more anyway. But yeah, that'd be my thoughts.
I could have added one thing onto that. I would say that choosing the right advisors to help you is important when you're leading up, especially if it's first time in, because there is going to be an element of you just don't know what you don't know. And then also back to the thing that we've all been saying with the clarity, if it's not your first time, the fundamentals of what a good business is are relatively fixed, and so you should almost half know the questions you're going to be asked. And so it's those are the things, thinking ahead of time, going, I know this is going to be coming up. We all have audits, we all get through those yearly events, you go, that's not going to be ideal, but this is different. An audit is like a very, very light version of DD and going into a private equity investment. So it's going, right, let's really think, what is going to come up? How can we solve that? Or how can we say, actually, yes, this was an issue? Because, those DD processes are pretty involved. And that's a good thing for both sides of the party. But I'd say it's coming. Do it in advance. Don't hope something doesn't come out. You should plan ahead of time, really.
Yeah, so make the time for that preparation's really key.
I think as well, though, on the way in, those processes can be quite time intensive.
Yeah.
So, there's a finite window. If you have that sort of exclusivity period and you're trying to sort of finalise the diligence, doing your prep and making sure that you're ready to go so that you can really get to those important questions early in the process. yep. rather than at the end of the process where it could really impact value.
I mean, just to add to that, so you have to add some sort of time scales to that. So if we're running, you know, a standard private equity process, you know, we would be working with that business probably 4 to 6 months before mm-hmm. coming to market at least. And that would be, you know, a pretty intensive period for the management team. It would be, you know, building the business plan, building the financial models, building the data cube, going through vendor-led diligence, which is where you effectively do diligence on yourselves to identify the red flags and come up with a way of addressing them. So, you know, this isn't a couple of weeks. This is, you know, 4 to 6 months mm-hmm. before you even come to market. Yeah, there's a lot of burden on the finance team in particular, given they're often the key holders to all the data.
So once investment is secured, we're into that first 100 days. That's a real critical time for a newly invested business. Matt, can I come to you first? What would you say are the top priorities for a CFO during this time?
There's a lot is the first, and also this 100 days will fly by, literally fly by. I'll use two C's on it. What it is having what is the content and what is the cadence of what they want to see. So you know, they'll have gone through a DD process. During that DD process, which will have taken some time to build up, there will be what is the management team's objectives and strategy for growth. So they're hoping to see, as we all would be, that we're on track with that. So it's making sure that we're clear on how we're going to demonstrate that and ultimately when. They'll all have their idea of cadence, and equally you're likely to have some debt in there as well. So it's not just going to be equity that's invested. They're almost always pairing that with some senior debt and then some other facility debt as well. So it's how is that going to be? Because you just don't want to miss that. Because that could be something new where we haven't been doing those reports. We don't realise that there's an intermediary that we have to go through, like Glass, for example, that I've used in the past for debt. So it's being really clear, what are you looking to see by when? And then in that period of time, you know, I like to say the world can happen and you can go off plan. You can go up or you can go down, but it's trying to make sure that there's a really clear way of articulating if you're seeing headwind or if something is not happening to plan. Because, and even before I went into private equity, there was a fantastic individual who gave me a little bit of mentoring when I was like an FC or something. And he said, I think you should go into PE. I think this could be a world where you'd enjoy it. And I looked into it and he said, I'll tell you one thing. And he was quite a character. He said, no surprises. And he said it in that way. He said, that's what PE, they just don't want surprises. And so it's making sure that if anything's coming, it's how you deliver that. So I would say those are the focal points. Getting in place and, quite frankly, saying what you're going to do and doing it in its simplistic form. But again, to my point earlier in our conversation, they're there for you to win. It doesn't have to be, you know, some people's perceptions, this antagonistic relationship, he sort of interfering. They want you to win, because if they win, we win. If we win, they win. And so it's going to them and saying, you know, how do you want to see this? What's easy for you to digest and compare, and making sure you're getting that in place. But those first 100 days, they'll go real fast.
Yeah, Michelle, as Matt says, that first 100 days will really speed by, and there could potentially be conflicting priorities between focus on growth and that day-to-day financial management. Is there anything you would advise a CFO during this time?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose if you think about the lead up to that, it's been an incredibly stressful period. We talked about that sort of 4 to 6 months pre-deal. You've had the stress of the actual deal itself, and I think some of those dynamics in terms of, especially if maybe the founders go in as part of the deal, and obviously they've been focused very much on maximising their value. So it's all about then driving the actual plan. And I would say it's very much then you will have talked about value creation prior to the deal. Mm. There'll be a very clear plan around value creation, and it's being focused on those things. They're likely to initially be around sort of cash and liquidity and cost optimization. It'll be different depending on whether you are the platform or actually you are coming together as part of that platform instead. So yeah, not an easy time without a doubt.
Like you say, it will have been clear going into this period. So actually staying focused on what those conversations were at that time is really important.
Yeah, if you think about it, right, like there's a business case supporting the acquisition. Mm. Like that first 100 days should be all about like ensuring that business case has got off to the strongest possible start.
Yeah.
The plans are in place and,
yeah,
you know, we talk about reporting and the reporting cadence, but there's also sort of the commercial realization, right? Like again, if it's a plug into a broader platform or if it's about enhancing R&D to sort of like deliver a product, like, you know, delivering that business case and creating that value and making sure that you've started on that journey.
And that 100-day plan, you know, it is a thing, you know, that will get drafted as you come probably through the latter half of a process. And there'll be, you know, we mentioned red flags already today. There'll be red flags out of diligence reports that are picked up and addressed in that 100-day plan. There'll be pieces of, I guess, more strategic points around, you know, potentially exploring new markets or whatever. But, you know, that is something that is produced and actioned, and you become accountable to it in the first 3 months of the investment. So it is a known. It's not just talked about.
I think also just on all those points as well, it is a process that you go through in a transaction event. I won't quote how little sleep I ended up having in the final 2 weeks of a process. And, you know, those advisory teams around you and your team are going to go through that intensity. And also, it's not a marathon. So when you finish, you don't get to just stop at the finish line. You know, that 100-day plan is then you're on again. So I think it's just being very mindful in forming that plan to be realistic, because you will have gone through a set of intensity and then that doesn't drop to zero, but you will need to be building back up into it. And it is an exciting time. You know, you really, really thrive. You can thrive in that environment, but it's making sure that it flows into being clear. And I suppose it's the final point is what are the non-negotiables? These are just happening as part of that plan, and that's what that plan's there to do. It's agreeing what you're all going to do.
And what digital tools, Stephen, do you think can help during this period of time?
Oh, I mean, there's loads, right? If you think about everything that's happening in the broader like digital transformation agenda, like everyone's got some form of a digital transformation that they're working on. I mean, you really need to align it to the business outcomes that you're trying to drive and you're trying to deliver. Take a CRM, right? A CRM is an opportunity for you to sort of store all your customer data in one place that enables you to monetize all the way throughout that customer journey, deliver a better experience. Can take quite a bit of time to implement and get it right depending on the size and scale. And again, you need to link that into sort of the strategy. Is it around acquiring new customers? Is it about expanding and cross-selling into your existing install base? So having that knowledge is key. ERP, you know, having an ERP that can scale and automate is so important. It can really take away some of the manual processes. It can enable the business to grow without a proportional increase in costs. So having a good ERP and a solid financial accounting tool in there is really important. And I suppose the other one, if you think about a business's biggest cost, is often its people. So having like a proper human capital management tool in there, one that can automate payroll, can just increase the employee experience and really maximize that asset, I think can be really powerful. So as you can see, right, every part of the business could go through a digital transformation, but it's all about prioritizing and linking into that original business case.
Yeah, I think that's really key, isn't it? Because none of those things are overnight fixes, but actually getting the wheels in motion during this initial period could really bring some value quite quickly to the business once they're in place.
Absolutely.
And Robert, how should financial teams approach the discussions with the PE house during this period of time in this first phase?
Yeah, so so the first phase, as we said, you know, that first 3 months, you're going to be going into that, you know, on the back of potentially some sleepless nights, getting the deal over line. But you know, there's going to be a load more stakeholders to manage, you know, especially if this is your first private equity deal. You'll have gone from a group of people who are very familiar with the business, that have, you know, potentially the founders, the board, has been together for a while. Suddenly you've got, you know, one or two new members on that board, and the board room will look slightly different. You know, private equity are very good at taking a management information pack and effectively tweaking it or adding in other KPIs, or, you know, basically getting the reporting in order, and that will feed into the board meeting. But I think a point that is often overlooked, the finance team has got to manage those stakeholders, because they are financially focused. So, you know, alongside the private equity guys, you've also got potentially a new debt provider. Yep. So, you know, although they won't be on the board, they will have their own reporting requirements. And because of the way private equity deals are structured, I guess servicing the debt and the cash flow management becomes a really big part of your day to day. So you've gone from a world of, you know, knowing everyone around the board table really well to having new people on it, all with different priorities around the information that they need. So the finance team role has, you know, got to be, I guess, data production, but also stakeholder management.
Yeah, I'd not thought about that relationship element that the finance team has got to focus on during that time. It's good insight if they're going into that, like you say, for the first time, and and taking that on as well.
Yeah, I'd very much agree on the point of cash. You almost flip your financial instruments that you're looking at. You know, it's used to be maybe P&L into balance sheet and then cash flow, sometimes done depending on the businesses. Whereas, you know, you'll come in and that agreement that you have in place will have covenants in it, which may be new and novel to people. And those are things you want to be miles ahead of and away from every time. So you're almost looking at it from reverse. Where's the cash? Keep everyone comfortable on that. Are we balance sheet? Is that safe, secure? Again, it's that comfort piece. And then the financials and the P&L at the very end, which gives you the you know, your curve into true value creation. So I'd agree.
So the whole premise around effectively building a private equity structure is to get the cost of capital to the lowest point. Now, private equity, we've already mentioned, looking to kind of double or triple their investment over that 3 to 5 year horizon. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to minimize the dilution for the existing shareholders and the management team coming through. So what you do is you introduce a strip of debt into that structure to bring that overall cost of capital down. But, you know, there's a very fine balancing act between the ability of the business to service that debt from a cash flow perspective, and, you know, putting as, you know, not as much as possible, but, you know, a good amount to bring that cost capital down and bring the returns up. Because it's beneficial to the private equity house, but it's also beneficial for all the shareholders that are rolling into the new structure.
Okay, so we've got through our first 100 days. We're then into the more medium-term priorities. And I presume growth is a big part of this period of time where value creation's going to be front of mind. Matt, once the dust has settled, how does the role of the CFO evolve during this period?
So you're through those first 100 and now you're hopefully getting into your cadence. And value creation is absolutely the right words to use, because that's what we are ultimately there for. The role of finance and as the CFO, you are, again, not to sound a broken record, you're looking to give that consistency, you know, the comfort that we are on track, and also deliver the ultimate plan. You know, if we've got some bigger capital projects, you know, systems is definitely one of them. And ultimately, it's trying to show that you have got the synergistic benefits that you were starting to say as part of that plan, be it sort of buy and build, be it integrations. And, you know, I would agree with Steve on the comments that were said. The right choice of systems can really enhance two very critical things: cost to serve and our activities, and accuracy. You know, nothing's infallible, but generally a system is going to, you know, give you that over people, and people are a really large cost. You know, with the latest announcements in the budget and the NI increase alone, you know, that has had material impact when I've been speaking with other CFOs who I know in my network and what that means for that cost of labour. So I think going into that future cadence, and I mentioned it before and we touched on that structuring of that debt, it's really looking to show we're on the plan, we're mitigating risk. Some organizations won't have, you know, clarity on how they demonstrate risk and mitigate risk. So making sure you've almost got, you know, it doesn't need a full-blown risk committee, but, you know, having risk being something that you're constantly talking about, looking at mitigating, and the covenants that we mentioned before as well, showing that, you know, there was more than enough headroom away from those to give that clarity. And I suppose the final thing is you're sort of going through it, showing and demonstrating that plan, but sometimes it's surfacing opportunity. You know, good financial data, not just internal, but external, you know, that can say, you know, we have opportunity here. Depending on what your debt structure or deal structure is, you might have an acquisitions facility that's set aside. You know, that's great that you've got that in the arsenal to be deployed, but we have to be, in finance, almost the critical friend. So you'll see a lot of the time in these high growth entities that is going to be where PE target, they're entrepreneurial. You know, that means they like to be nimble. They're probably a little bit more up the risk scale of what they're willing to take. And especially if they were founder managed before, they've probably taken some risks. And so you need to be that balance in finance to say, we don't want to curtail that enthusiasm, which is going to keep fueling that double-digit growth, which is what is highly likely. But let's just make sure it is also data-led. And that's where having the right systems to help give a very objective view to support a subjective sort of entrepreneurial personality is key with that sort of balance in a finance function.
I'd just add to that, you know, I think there's, if you're kind of sat here listening to this going, thinking about, you know, wanting to run a PE process, you know, there's no time better than the present to kind of start and get some of that data in order. We mentioned the prep earlier, but, you know, the way that private equity are looking at opportunities now is far more analytical. You know, when they appraise an opportunity, yes, they'll have endless conversations with the management team. They'll seek external validation for their, I guess, equity story. But, you know, a huge part of the analysis that's done in that appraisal phase will be on this concept of like a data cube, and that will bring all different aspects of the business into a single data, I guess, warehouse, if you like, and that'll be customer information out of the CRM, it'll be financial information out of the ERP, it'll be operational data about how the business runs, it'll be HR data out of the HR platform, and it'll also be sales data, you know, looking at sales team performance and those, you know, if the more data you can have that you are readily analyzing even before a process, the smoother that process will be, and ultimately that stuff does go to value.
And I suppose that's one of the interesting things about this conversation, right, is that PE process, it's not just financial data.
No.
As you alluded to there, like, it's increasingly reaching into operational.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking at the sales pipeline, it's looking at how the sales team's performing, it's looking at the number of employees you have and your average cost for employee head. And I suppose, Matt, I'd be curious, just as part of that P process, I always think of like the FD as like the custodian of the data. even if it's increasingly not financial.
Yes, you are the conduit. So you will find through the process that I went through, you know, no matter what they were asking for, it came through you, and you're there to sort of be that person who's able to go, I can understand why you're asking that. This is where we can go, and sort of you almost become a PM and project manage that sort of process from your side, ensuring that you get that flow. But I couldn't agree more. It's not just the EBITDA. It's not just the P&L or even the other financial instruments that they're looking for. They really want to know the business and understand the business. And the more objective that can be, and the longer term, as you were saying, Rob, that you have been monitoring that and tracking that, it is really important and key.
Well, I think, if there's one thing that's become increasingly, at the front of processes, you make a point about a business, a positive selling message. You've got to substantiate that with data out of all of those systems that we mentioned. But also, as you're going through the PE appraisal phase and they're asking questions of you, it is less and less becoming just a reasoning that is only verbally communicated. You're verbally communicated, but then you'll also have to send data that substantiates the point. And frankly, if that data's not there or it's not readily available, it slows the whole process down, and ultimately can impact the outcome. So, I think if there's one thing we've learned over the last probably 5 to 10 years, as more systems are in more businesses and the data is captured, private equity want to see it. They want to understand it before they make the investment.
I'm guessing you will have seen this as well, Rob, that we're finding due diligence taking a lot longer.
Yeah.
And it's a hell of a lot more detailed than it probably would have been. So it's backed up by, I think, all of these conversations that's why.
Yeah, and let's just dig into a point you mentioned, which was that buy and build might be a strategy here. Because if we're buying different businesses, you potentially got different businesses on different technology, and that reporting and integrating all of that data together could be a real challenge. How would you manage that as a CFO?
Yeah, we've touched on the buy and build principle, which is a common method. I would say I've gone into entities and seen entities where they've gone with a buy and build approach, but the critical part is to not just be buy and sometimes inadvertently forget the build or become less focused on it, especially if it's quite a fragmented industry where the spread of acquisition potential is immense. I can give first-hand example where they come like buses sometimes in one entity. We had our pipeline, quite an excessive pipeline of potential target opportunities, and three came simultaneously for us to acquire literally in the same week started. Gosh. So now you're like, wow. And you have to back yourselves to go, we can do this, because we don't always get to choose the opportunity of the timing. But to go back to the value creation journey, buying them, even if at a lower multiple, and going, oh, we'll get some arbitrage and enhance the multiple on the next phase, that's great. I've always said that's a bonus we'll take, but it can't be the merit that we judge it on. And you have to have that integration plan, because you can have the perception that you've created value, but actually, from the objective view of all this DD now, they'll step back and go, why? Why does this group exist? Why have you brought these together? And you do need to be quite clear on that, because they'll go, I feel this is going to be a problem that I have trying to get these to work together better. And to your point, Steve, it's the platform. So how I like to do it is go, right, what is our platform for the future going to be? Where do we need our platform to look and feel and do in 5 years or more from now? put it in. Sometimes that feels maybe a little bit overkill at the point you're putting it in. But then you go, right, our acquisition, our buy and build strategy now becomes you come in and these, more often than not, these back office functionalities or support functionalities will become centralized. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that people are removed from those entities. Sometimes they stay exactly in situ, but their reporting lines just come into a middle, so you get continuity. Your systems will change onto our platform, so we can all talk together better, more efficiently. You know, and even banking, having a plan, because you know, it's highly unlikely what you're acquiring is going to A, have the same system as you, and B, the same banking. So it's very much that. Buying has its challenges, but actually the true value comes from the integration and the build element of it.
And I think this really touches on like the digital transformation piece, because what unlocks that integration complexity is having systems and tools that talk to one another. Mm. Because in a world where you don't integrate and you keep things separate, it can effectively become a brick wall. Mm. One which where you don't really fully understand whether the sort of the commercial thesis that's underpinned the transaction is being delivered, because you can't actually measure and understand like the true value or impact of what that commercial strategy has been. So I think, you know, it's often a part where you see like a lot of like businesses that get bought and the integration just doesn't quite go that final step.
Yeah.
And it's exactly in that exit story where having gone through the pain of the integration early doors means that when you do come to look at the next stage of investment, you have that historical run rate where you can really demonstrate that as a management team, you created the value.
I think you know, when we're helping teams sort of design that, I guess, acquisition strategy, you know, always start from the point of being strategic rather than opportunistic. You know, even if you're not private equity backed currently, you'll have endless opportunities to acquire businesses. You know, there's loads of advisors out there trying to, you know, encourage you to buy similar businesses or ones that they think are a good fit. Ultimately, you have to decide. And you know, we've even seen it go as far as, you know, effectively kill processes that are for those buy and build platforms where the integration perhaps hasn't been as much of a focus as it should have been. And you know, how the group sits together isn't that obvious, and that's unfortunately where people have been opportunistic, looking at the potential to get multiple arbitrage rather than actually trying to build, you know, a group that sits together and makes a lot of commercial sense. And you know, I guess one of the bits of rigor that private equity do bring is, you know, on day one of that 100-day plan, or you know, even well before they make the investment, they have an eye on an exit route, and building something that fits that route of exit is critical. So the minute you deviate from that by buying something that because it's cheap rather than because it's strategic, is where you start to encounter problems.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I've never encountered a PE house who, when entering, hasn't already also firmly planned exit.
Yeah,
you know, they that's critical. And to your point, I think if your model is buy and build, and your future model is buy and build, if you can't really demonstrate the build element in phase one, then it just undermines the credibility, and sometimes a deal will fall down because the credibility is not there to show actually the plan is that.
And I think on the value creation point, sorry to keep harping on about the data, but it's really important, you know, to effectively demonstrate that group cohesion of when you've acquired a business. You know, simple practical things like flagging where that customer originated from, so that you know, if it's from the acquired business, you can demonstrate that you've cross-sold other products from the group to it, or you've upsold other products to, you know, being able to accurately evidence those points as part of a process is massively value enhancing, but it comes back down to having the quality of data in the first place.
Yeah, and technology is so key to that, and the integration of technology. And we've talked a lot about the integration of the business, but actually that integration of the technology, so you've got one view of the world, so key to that. Before we move on, any advice you would give to finance teams who are embarking on that technology view of the, you know, thinking about what they're going to put in place? Stephen, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I think that, as I mentioned earlier, right, like every component of a business could be subject to digital transformation. But I think that in finance, there really is an opportunity to sort of like capture digital transformation and to really sort of help automate and drive processes. So if I think about it, there's probably places around revenue optimization, making sure you've got tools in place that can help with pricing, that can help with rev rec, making sure that you really minimize that revenue leakage. You can use tools to optimize and drive working capital, looking at the purchase to pay or the quote to cash type system, getting those systems and tools in place to really optimize cash flow. And as we talked about earlier, right, like in a PE focused world, the understanding around cash and your cash flow and your working capital management is crucial. But I think in finance, and this is how I see the role of a CFO evolving, is around the data and the analytics. Increasingly, you'll be able to provide real-time analytics, and that enables CFOs and finance functions to really step up and be more strategic advisors to the business, help the business understand the risks and opportunities, and actually capitalize on them as they're materializing.
Yeah, definitely. Anything you would add, Michelle, regarding that transparency that the finance team are trying to get to?
I think a lot of the points you made were things that in advance were kind of everything that I would echo in terms of absolutely from day one, PE've already thought about what the exit probably looks like and that working backwards. I think that was kind of front of mind for me, was it's all about kind of building to that next exit, because that's for them. Yes, they're buying the business as is, but they're buying the story and the potential of what they think it's going to be at exit.
So Rob, how should businesses approach funding strategies during this time if they're either investing in tech or they're looking to acquire businesses?
Yeah, so look, we've talked about this whole focus on cash. And, you know, the cash is there to service the debt. It's there to kind of fuel the growth. But there are actually, I guess, a couple of funding options as you go through that private equity journey. And I'll just touch on a few of them. So let's take the instance where there's a great strategic acquisition that you want to go and do. But you know, you've not got enough surplus cash on the balance sheet to go and acquire it. So you need some new funding. What are your options? So, you know, the way I'd always approach this is, you know, what is the most efficient and what is effectively the lowest cost of capital? So, you know, first you go to your debt provider and you'd say, look, you know, it's a fantastic business we want to acquire. It will add this amount of EBITDA, and you know, potentially with some synergies and some cost savings, it might add a bit more. Please, will you effectively refinance our debt package on the combined group's earnings? So that will unlock hopefully a bit more cash, and you'll sort of re-lever back up to the combined group's earnings, but you're still a bit short. So what options have you got outside of that? Well, in reality, you're probably going to have to go back to the private equity house and request some more equity type of funding, or in fact, some low note funding. And we won't go into low notes today, but effectively, that's a debt-like instrument that the private equity fund will provide. And depending where they are in that investment cycle, they will have a level of appetite for that. If it's a couple of months before the exit, the appetite will be very low. If it's a couple of months since they invested, then the appetite will be very high, and that's all about their blended returns. But what's going to happen at that point is you're going to ask them to revalue the business, because when you've combined the two, that the group should be worth more. So when they put some more cash into the business, it should be a different value to that they first invested. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll be, if it's the right acquisition, they'll be really supportive and they'll make it happen. You know, outside of doing a acquisition, if you're wanting to invest in tech or build something on a software perspective, you know, you said earlier, Matt, that PE don't like surprises. So when you're building out that plan in the first instance, if on the horizon is a replatforming or a CapEx type spend, that should already be in your cash flow forecasts, and that there shouldn't suddenly be a hole. So you know, managing your cash up, you know, in advance of making that piece of CapEx is really important. You know, there are types of debt funding that can support you with that, but ultimately, you shouldn't end up with a cash need for something that you sort of knew about was going to happen at some point during that investment cycle anyway.
Agree. Absolutely. You know, there are certain levels of expectation where you can manage that through, especially if it's part of the overall strategic plan, because you'll have cash modeled it. So I would agree with that.
And I think, as you said, like on the way in, the PE house often has its view on how it will derive value, and you know, acquisitions can be part of that, investments in platforms, in tools to help transform the way they shape business. The thing that always anchors it is that we keep coming back to the value creation, but if it's in the business case before, you know, all these things are typically in the business case. They're the plan of the private equity. They've been modeled in the cash flow. So it's all there, but like really being able to demonstrate the ROI of that investment and making sure that investment will be used to deliver and create the value that will drive future growth is really key.
It's fair to say a lot of private equity aren't massive fans of heavy CapEx projects, you know, unless you are an infrastructure type business or an industrials business, where typically you will have a type of private equity that are more comfortable with that type of model, and they're not massive fans of, I guess, large amounts of CapEx, because that's cash walking off the balance sheet that they might not, I guess, derive value from on exit. And you know, if the cash is on the balance sheet, then they'll get rewarded for it on exit. So I'm not saying that they're unwilling to invest, but you know, they're going to be less keen on doing a really heavy CapEx project, you know, late on in their investment cycle, because they're not going to derive the value from it, and they're not going to derive the earnings from it that they will then see in their exit multiple.
Yeah, so timing's really key, but then I suppose also looking at options that aren't CapEx, like subscription for software, for example, could be a way of bringing it above the line so that it's not a CapEx at any point in that period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously the way that kind of licensing's changed over the last few years has meant that kind of, you know, heavy investment in upfront licenses is reduced, isn't it? So, you know, they would always be willing to invest in systems is what I would see, especially if it's not a CapEx type spend.
So let's move towards the exit now. So we've spent that medium term focused on value creation. I'd love to jump into how CFOs are preparing for exit during this time and what they're considering. So Rob, let's start with you. So what are the strategic considerations that CFO needs to make during that period towards the exit?
Yeah, okay. So as we've talked about, that kind of 4 to 6 months pre-coming to market is intense for the finance team. You know, we've talked about the CFO or that finance team being the conduit of data, and a lot of that period is data prep. But I think what I would say is, because the FD CFO, the leader of that finance team during that process, will be expected to dedicate a large portion of their day to day to the process, having a team around that individual that is capable of running the BAU, running the day to day finance team, is absolutely invaluable. And you know, if you're considering going through that phase and you don't have a team that you can lean on to continue running the business effectively, then you know, look to find appropriate people to put in that role, because the number of times when we're working with businesses in that sort of intense prep phase, trading dips because that, I guess, strategic management team is focused on the sale process rather than driving the business day to day. And that is frankly the worst situation to end up in, because if you start missing your forecasts in a process, it just erodes value. So I think I'd probably focus on building a team around you to support you in that process. And you know, some of that will be advisors externally and some of it will be an internal resource.
Matt, you mentioned before that sleepless nights before the start of this whole process, is it similar sort of as you run to exit that sleepless nights are kicking in? And
so I suppose it's sleepless nights because your mind will be racing, but also less sleep as a whole. You know, I think throughout anyone's finance career, finance as a function is very peak and trough. Sometimes more peaks than troughs. You know, we go through cycles, don't we? We go through the month end, the quarter, the annual audit. You know, there are these peaking moments, and this is, you know, probably one of the heights of peaks is going through a process like this. I couldn't agree more with Rob on some of the comments that he was saying through that. And I was actually going to say, your focus up until that period, when you're actually going through the event, your ducks have to have already been in the row. If you're trying to build it on the fly now, I hate to say, you're a bit late. And so that's why you do need to be thinking ahead of time. You know, even going through a soft DD process, like almost like a practice run, you know, and to some of the comments we'd said before, you know, we know what they're going to ask. We should know. And if you've got a decent advisor, they'll fill in the gaps as well. They'll be that critical friend for you. But when you're going through that, you have to be really clear on how you're supporting the business continuing. You know, a process should be seen as a completely separate project. You should resource accordingly, internal, external, however you wish to do it. But Rob's absolutely spot on. The worst time you can come off those numbers is while everyone's got their microscopes out and saying, oh, we just struggled to cope because of all the questions you asked. You knew they were going to ask these questions. So you do need to give yourself the best opportunity to win in that environment, because they're wanting to know those answers. But I think the setup is critically important. You have to allow the business to keep doing its BAU. You know, when I was going through my exit process, those three acquisitions, they were actually happening at the same time.
Oh, gosh.
So we were having to say, look, this is a great opportunity. We're going through this transaction event just due to the timing of every bus all coming at once here. But you still have to go. But we know that and we have to work through it. So allowing BAU to happen, you know, to within reason, because we all cut our budgets and forecasts at a different point in time. Give yourself a target that maybe is a tad bit softer to make sure you're hitting it during that period of time. Don't give yourself something that's really stretching that's then going to put too much stress and strain, because you might go, but if we predict here where we're going to go, our value and arbitrage will be this. But actually, that and missing it is more damaging than saying, this is what we'll be, and then bang on the money, you're on those numbers. So I think that's a part to play with the finance function and the CFO to be that critical balance. And I think it was yourself, Rob, who said, you know, some of these, you know, the owner's been in the business a really long time, and everyone might be not going on the next journey. There might be some exits. They'll be like, this is my moment of value. So yeah, they'll be there going, let's say it's this, because they're not delivering that. Yeah, they'll have gone. So you need to sort of try and be that very objective data-led individual.
And Michelle, what would you see as critical during that due diligence process for the finance team?
I think it goes back to, we're going over the same points, but because it's important, data.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, it's not about the 6 months before and then going, actually, have we got this data? It's, you know, right from the beginning of you moving into being a portfolio business, it's having that richness of data so that when you need it, you can clearly create that story and that you can data back up the growth that you've delivered. I think we're seeing a lot more businesses are looking at vendor due diligence as well, particularly if they're looking at a broader buyer pool. And I suppose what that helps, because it's the due diligence on yourself, that again helps with the red flags, helps to make sure that you are in readiness. But again, that vendor due diligence is very much, a lot of that pressure is built around the finance team.
And I think just to add that to that on vendor due diligence, you know, for the processes that we're running, if there's private equity involvement, we'd almost say that, you know, vendor due diligence is pretty much a hygiene factor now. Mm. And the reason for that is, yes, because you get to, you know, see the red flags or see the orange flags even before anyone else and have an opportunity to address them. But also it just helps in the process to maintain momentum and avoid late on nasty surprises. So, you know, the one of the worst meetings you can ever have is with a private equity house that hasn't seen any vendor-led diligence and has done the diligence themselves, and they come back and present the report and go, because of X, Y, and Z, we're changing the value or changing the deal structure. Mm. And that's kind of, you know, that is the nastiest of nasty surprises. So, you know, if you're of a certain scale, I guess, and you want to run a process with multiple private equity houses within it, just get that vendor diligence done ahead of time, and effectively control the process a bit more.
And Stephen, is there anything you can advise CFOs to ensure they've got prepared?
Well, I think, you know, we've touched on some great points there going through. The CFO is the custodian of the numbers and the custodian of the data, and that is ultimately what is driving that enterprise value. So making sure that they're prepared, and I think the point around making sure you've got a team around you that's supporting, that enables you to deliver on that, is really crucial. And I think also, just, you know, you will always be looked at in that boardroom as a CFO or as an FD as the person who they trust because of the nature of your qualification and because of the role and the analytical role that you play within the business. And I think as a CFO, being really comfortable with that equity story and understanding the data points that underpin that equity story that ultimately have demonstrated you've delivered value. And I think that's where we come back to the data and we come back to the digital transformation that hopefully you started early in the process of the investment, that means that you can really support your equity story with data points that really help, you know, create that value and drive those high exit prices.
Okay, as we wrap up, I'd love to step back and just take a look at the role of the CFO, particularly within PE, but how it's evolving. So, Stephen, it's a real evolving space for a CFO. How do you see the reliance on digital tools and transformation affecting that evolution for the CFO?
I think increasingly the CFO is expected to be a strategic advisor. It's an assumption and it's a prerequisite that they're on top of their data and that they know the story and that they know the data. And the power of digital transformation is really the timeliness of that insight. So if a CFO is a strategic advisor, then they need to have the information at their fingertips. And you can only do that if you've got the right sort of technology platform supporting your business.
Matt, I'll come to you. How would you advise other finance professionals to stay ahead of the curve in PE environment or just generally as a CFO that's evolving in role?
Yeah, so I've been really fortunate to work in probably quite a long list of entities now of varying sizes, legal structures, demographics and sectors. And what I'd say I've learned is relatively applicable across all, but within PE and trying to stay ahead of the curve, as it were, I'd say going into any role, it's first and foremost being curious. You need to have curiosity in your role as the CFO. And then I'll build in this order. You need to be fastidious, regardless of the level you are, the size of entity. And it's not just you. You have to permeate that down to the point we were saying about an exit. You have to have a team that can run the BAU. And the BAU is ever more expansive as you go through certain events. So curiosity, fastidious. For some time, I used to say you can't trust, but then I never liked that as a term. I said you can't trust anything, yeah? I've finally settled on being skeptical. And there is a difference in that. You have to have some level of skepticism, because I've definitely been caught out before thinking, well, surely that's a fundamental. It has to just be being done. And I've had it verbalized. Yeah, we're on this. It's fine. It's not been fine, yeah? And you need to be, and then that leads me. So that skepticism, that curiosity then becomes to being data-led, yeah? I hear what you say. I trust you immensely as a person. Please just show me, for my own skepticism, in data, that this is okay, that this is trending in this way, that we do have this level of sensitivity and materiality on our covenants, for example. So I think it's that. And then finally, I would say any form of advice, it does link back to be someone who makes sure throughout all the organization, not just your finance function, that there is that culture that risks will be materialized and surfaced, and so in a timely manner. And couldn't agree more, Steve, with how you said. So how I've got a real passion for sort of the FP&A side. That was where my career came through, less through standard transactional finance to start with. Obviously, I transitioned at some point, but sort of that FP&A. And how I sort of distilled that down over time is a really great finance function and finance leadership. A, they're blended together. I don't see a CFO sat at the top. Everything that you think and feel has to be permeated through that organization, and your structure is, if you're really partnering in a strategic way with the business and the CEO and every facet, it's being able to be data-led and help the business make material decisions in a timely manner, so that you're able to mitigate risks before they're crystallizing. And ultimately, because let's be positive as well, not just talk about risk, is to be able to capitalize on opportunity. And it's the timing. If you take so long to be able to validate an opportunity, sometimes you've missed it. Mm. And being able to be so quick and confident with that is key.
Rob, I'll just come to you on that point. What new skills are you seeing finance leaders and their teams need, particularly in this private equity environment?
That differs depending on whether it's your first, step into private equity, or whether you're sort of a seasoned private equity CFO or finance leader. And I think if you're coming into it for the first time, it's your role is going to evolve whether you sort of like it or not, and you're going to go from being kind of the leader of the numbers and making sure that the finances are orderly and I guess up to date, but you're going to become a far more strategic thinker, and that is what the private equity house are going to ask of you. And that never stops evolving, whether it's your second or third kind of, foray into a private equity business. That strategic thinking with that constant level of commerciality. You mentioned it earlier, sort of managing risk, but also being able to take opportunity. You've got to have a team around you and the data around you to make quick decisions. That's what the private equity house will expect of you. That's what you should expect of yourself, because, you know, let's not forget, if this all goes well, everyone's going to win, including you, not just the private equity house. So I would say become more strategic, become more commercial, become ready to make quick decisions.
And Michelle, can I just come to you? How do you think a CFO can balance that traditional responsibility that they have in the financial skills with all the things we've talked about today, that stakeholder management, the investor relations piece, the reporting and the data and insight piece that they need today?
I think we've got to go back to the point we mentioned earlier about that strength of team underneath you. So it may be that when you first took investment, that strength of that team wasn't there. So over that period, have you been able to have that team in place that enables you to then do that more strategic thinking, being able to put automation into place? And it's that continuous learning. If I take, for example, ESG, if I go back 3 to 5 years ago, I don't think that was as important. I think it's really come to the fore now. So it might be that some of the things that you needed to be aware of and think about when you first took investment, as opposed to when you were exiting, those things have moved on. So if you're able to keep yourself up to date and skilled, again, working alongside an advisor, that then means that, you know, you're ready.
Yeah, it's so key, isn't it? And even as AI becomes more prevalent within business technology, for example, that continuous learning, continuous development for CFOs is going to be really, really key. And just one final point, and Matt, I'll come to you first. How do you think, you know, with teams being so key to this, how do you attract the right talent to bring into your teams during this time?
I think you need to give them clarity of, you know, what the ultimate vision is. I think I've had the pleasure of working with, you know, some truly great individuals. And I still remember a tipping point when I used to work at Canterbury, where I finally went, wow, some of my team know more than me. And that was a sort of pivotal point for me going, you know, in sort of my change from being an FC and sort of a wider leader. To attract people, I do think there's that clarity. And you have to care about them as well, if I'm being really honest. I've had certain individuals who've worked with me more than once, more than twice in different organizations. And I think that's because, you know, you've built up that trust and respect to one another. And to my very earlier point on sort of, there are things that are, you know, a two-way street. And so if you genuinely believe that not only can they add value to the organization and your team, but you can truly give them an opportunity, then it almost sells itself. And I think honesty as well, you know, if you go that, you know, you have to say, there's a bit of a mountain here to climb, but I think this is why you're going to enjoy it. And this is where you're going to be rewarded from that, you know. And it's not just those packages and the numerics, you know, that's a part to play for people for sure. But it's, what could that mean? You know, what's it going to feel like is critically important. But I couldn't agree more. The assumption of what is just a given continues to expand in finance and the role of the CFO. And when that continues to just expand, you do need to create the space and structure to make sure it is just a given through systems, process, or people. And so, you know, for you to have that space, you do need that team below you. I mean, one of the terms I use is, what happens if you go under a bus? It's a little bit morbid, but you can't have anyone who metaphorically goes under the bus and the business be open to risk. You have to have that sort of structure in place.
It's so key to have those people around you and for them to feel a part of that journey, particularly in an environment where you're building value and you're building something for a third party, so that they know what they're bring into the party as well.
Yep, absolutely.
Before we dive into the different stages of investment, should we just talk a little bit about fundamentals? And Stephen, I'll come to you first. Can you briefly touch on what private equity is and how it differs from other forms of investment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, private equity is a very big statement. And if you layer it back, it's essentially investment in a privately backed business. That means it's not listed on a market. Private equity can fall into three different types of investment. The first one is probably at the early stage of a business, venture capital. That's about investing in a business model that's not proven, with a hope that it goes on and grows and that value can really expand. The purpose of private equity is, over the course of ownership, is to increase the value of the asset that they've invested into. That investment can, there's several different ways you can invest. One can be venture capital, which is an investment in the early stage of a business. It's often an unproven business model with a hope of big returns. There's growth equity, which is typically a more mature business where they need some capital to really expand the operation, really drive and grow the business. Or the final one is a management buyout. This is where they take a controlling interest in the business. And all of those strategies all really are about trying to shape the strategy of the business, shape the direction that it's traveling in, and also ensure that operationally there's a team in place to deliver and execute on that.
Great, thanks. And Michelle, what type of companies are typically attracting in private equity investment? Is there any particular industries?
Yeah, so I'd say from a sector perspective, we've seen a particular lot of activity in technology, healthcare, business services. For example, there are funds that focus purely on, say, consumer products. And then we are seeing some other smaller players that are taking a bit of a different view. So if I take purely the Northwest example of the likes of, say, a River Capital, where they're smaller check sizes, it is still PE, but probably of a different model. Typically where you find the reason PE want to invest in those type of businesses that I mentioned earlier is because they see a recurring revenue model, it's highly profitable, and they're on a very strong growth trajectory.
And Rob, can you walk us through a typical private equity investment and how it works?
Yeah, so look, private equity are looking to invest where they see opportunity. And as Steve has said, you know, whether that's in growth capital, looking at an early stage opportunity and funding everything up from an idea to kind of commercializing something into, you know, potentially a buy and build, which I'm sure we'll come on to later, where there's perhaps a slightly more established platform and they're looking to effectively inject capital to help make that buy and build story a reality. But, you know, there's an also a big part of private equity that are looking to provide succession. And by that, I mean, perhaps you've got a founder or, you know, a management team that has run that business who are now looking to move on. And there's an opportunity for that management team to do an MBO. So effectively buy out the existing shareholders. And, you know, let's not forget, they're also very active and have got a really important role to play when a business perhaps is underperforming. And, you know, that's a whole part of the market that is focused on seeing an opportunity for a business to perform better and going in and effectively evoking change. And that kind of that part of the market is huge within the UK and Europe. But in terms of how a private equity deal works, if you like, the private equity house comes with sort of two things: money and skills. And depending on those situations that we've talked about, there'll be a different blend. If it's the distress, then they'll be probably putting a lot of people into the business to help turn it around. If it's more of a management buyout, then they're backing the management team to deliver that growth. So in that instance, they're probably less on the skills and more on the money and strategic advice. But in terms of how it works, that was the original question, wasn't it? It's quite complex, it's fair to say. It involves incentivizing the management team to deliver the growth. It involves more often than not bringing in some debt into the structure to bring the cost of capital down, which maybe touch on later. But ultimately, where there's a need for money, they can come in and provide that. Without kind of speaking forever, I think we'll maybe answer that in a bit more depth as we come on to some more of the topics.
Perfect. Thank you, Rob. And Matt, just on the role of the CFO in this, how does private equity investment impact daily operations for a CFO?
Yeah, so building on what's already been said, probably. So Weird Evolution Funding. We are in automotive finance, but very much with a tech platform. And so the build up from them in what their interest was, because Carlyle, so we're backed by a tier one. So Carlyle, who invested, saw not only our position where we were, but again, where to go to. So with them coming on board, I liked how Rob just distilled it down into its money and resource and expertise, because that's what they do bring. And so how does it change the landscape of the finance function? If say, PE was new into that, is you'll find what they want to look at is different. It will be accretive to what you already produce, highly likely, and there will be a certain expectation of cadence in what they're looking for. And it's just critically important to make sure you're resourced and ready for that. Why are they doing that? Well, they're there to win if we win, and we win if they win, if it's an MBO, or anything like that. So, they're asking it so that they can understand the business and so they can feel comfort that the plan you formed as a management team is the plan that's happening. So, that could be an impact. Some people, when sort of PE is mentioned or VC or anything like that, there can sometimes be a little bit of apprehension, maybe even negativity because of maybe other people's experiences or just what they've heard. But like many things, it's embracing it for what it is. They do come with the ability. If they're going to invest, they believe in something. They are not going to give a penny or a pound away to something they don't believe in. And so they're there for that. Where you can utilize that and embrace it, so it's not just you feeling like I'm just telling them something on a weekly or monthly cadence and I'm just putting these reports out, is you can leverage them. You are probably one of a host of other organizations that they have invested in. And depending on which fund you've come into, you might find there are others in that investment portfolio that they have where you can gain some benefit. Sometimes you can sort of jump up a queue somewhere or gain some sort of commercial terms that would be beneficial because the PE house can assist. And more often than not, they've got some really clever people working there. And so they will be able to be that sounding board for you to be able to sort of assist in that support. So what's it like with PE? They're going to want to know more than you've probably divulged before. You might have done a cash flow every sort of 6 months or not at all, maybe, because you've just trusted the bank. But they're going to want to just know these things. But what they're asking 9 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10, it's good commercial practice anyway to have. So embracing it and then putting a little bit back on them is a way for you to gain some benefit too.
So there's real benefit in seeing them as a strategic partner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. With anything like that, I treat audits the same. Yeah. Yes, you could say it's a necessary evil. I've heard other CFOs say that. But if it's going to happen, get some benefit from it while you're doing it.
Thank you for taking the time to watch this private equity spotlight. On behalf of myself and the panel, we hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did and hopefully found some value from it as well.